Thank you for listening to a reading presented by the Poetry Center of Chicago. The Poetry Center is an independent, nonprofit arts organization promoting poetry in Chicago through readings, workshops, and arts education. To learn more about the Poetry Center, to read poems by our students in Chicago Public Schools, or to donate, please visit www.poetrycenter.org.
The next reader, besides being both poet Laureate nominees, is another four-syllable last name, Mr. Michael Anania. A few things to say about Michael, a little less formal because I know him personally. Michael taught at UIC for 35 years, and many of you in the audience attend UIC and are aware of this, but he left recently, much to the detriment of the program, and I think I can speak for many people in the audience when I say that we miss him dearly and that the program is not the same without him. In fact, I have not written a decent poem since you left, Michael, and that is very true. In part because Michael, probably more so than anyone I know, has such a vast amount of knowledge of modern poetry. Not only modern poetry, modern painting, jazz, dance, and surprisingly enough, women's shoes, though he's failed to comment on my boots tonight. He has numerous books out, his novel, The Red Menace, his most recent book of poetry, In Natural Light. But he also has an older book of poetry that many of you might not be familiar with, and I brought it along tonight for two reasons. The first is the cover, and this is for Michael and his students. The title is The Color of Dusk, and if you all know, it's that dreaded preposition of. So shame on you, Michael. But the back, and none of you can see it, unfortunately, is a picture of Michael. This was from 1970 with a very large mustache. And it is a sight to behold. And I don't know if any of you in the audience knew Michael when he had a mustache, but I did not. And it's a stunning picture. You can check it out afterwards. I'm going to read a segment from this book, which is from 1970, because I think it comments on Michael's own poems, or at least how I perceive them. And it's from a poem called Sheer Face. Do you remember this? We come after on Sunday morning to the top in a Plymouth Tudor, and I notice how the ground fog slides down channeled bluffs. And you say it's beautiful. I find that particular passage because I find this notion of fog being channeled and light throughout all of Michael's poems, and I think they are indeed beautiful. The other thing that is so heavily present in his poems is kinetic imagery and music, and I'm going to read a small section of another poem called Proem from Bonjour Buffalo, a romance. The bridge behind him, the river's dark luster, gulping in snow and light ahead, heel skid, pitch pipe, tire spun out, neons, frayed red line, electric blue veins, and transformers humming. And I read that particular passage because I think Michael's poems and Michael himself has a tendency to situate itself in your skin and continue humming. And I think that that's part of what's going on and this loss of him to the program. The last couple of things I want to say, I want to give a prescient statement. This book was put together, it's by Blue Sky Review, and all the editors are in the audience. It was put together for Michael's retirement. And one of Michael's friends and students wrote this, and this was last summer. He should be appointed Emperor of Poetry, or something grand. Poet Laureate would not do him justice. As young people used to say, but probably don't anymore, he rules. And as the editors of Blue Sky Review say, no matter how you define Michael, he remains hot stuff, coming through.
Well, Simone has done the impossible. She made me feel young again by showing that picture and then reading a poem that was written in 1965 and following it with a poem that was written in 1962. So I seem to know that guy. It's a great pleasure to be here tonight with Haki, somewhat daunting. That voice of his and the way his lines come out to those powerful endings has been in my head for 30 years, more than 30 years. It turns up in my poems. It'll happen in a poem tonight. But I'm going to follow something like the same pattern and start a while back and then move forward. A short poem which was in the first sequence of bus and subway poems ever, called Cantilena, Chicago poem. Buds, husks, leaves, and flowers gone, the ordinary city tree at dawn. The usual traffic, expected fumes, automatic music in darkened rooms, dance step, disco, action, weather, jive, top of the charts, only the strong survive. And this is a South Side poem. I think probably I'm going to start with this and then end with another poem in the same neighborhood. For about 14 years, I lived right at the corner of 31st and Indiana Street. And so it was my neighborhood in the city. That was a courtyard building, and the neat thing about courtyard buildings is that you participate in other people's lives, but not visually, but in terms of sound. You just listen to people's lives come up out of the courtyard. So that the statements that begin this poem are statements that I heard, and then the poem sort of rifts out after that. It begins with a quote from Walt Whitman. The poem is called Variations for a Summer Evening, and the quote is, "I have heard what the talkers were talking. Thank you and goodbye." And now she turns hair sway, skirt furling, the peonies, each one of them a pink tangle, sunlit quartz sidewalk, Lester leaps in. Flowering Cheyenne, lady fingers, white blossoms, bees and butterflies, the skyline, pure Chicago, this paper cut out of itself, water tower solitaires, a deuce and a quarter listing by. The voice I hear under the locust tree in the courtyard, so definite, the rush of the L, box elder, poplar stirring, all I want, she says, or anyone for that matter, is a chance to show you what I mean. Haze after haze, the city and evening, music seems implicit in conditions perfected years ago. Gaiety, the Venetian glass swirl of warm gin over ice, dear saxophone, the breathy instant before the sound comes on like anything. America, it's hardly worth mentioning, these happy accidents occur as they occur, something the horn ribbons out into moist air and indigo. To show you what I mean, like the lyric that stammers inside the song, embraceable you, never quite uttered, assumed, like Max Roach, an assistance that sometimes comes to call. Elm crowns above the scattered roof lines, my sweet. The smoke king so close you could hear him fingering the keys, embraceable valve pads opening and closing, riding above the notes and darkened leaves, breath flared like steam against lacquered brass. Sometimes this sadness is intolerable. All I want, the narrow leaves like fossils stamped in anthracite, or anyone, ice cubes hissing their breath away, an insistence turning just where the light furls round their sadness. Thank you and goodbye, my sweet, embraceable night air and its thickening apprehension. For that matter is a chance to show you what I mean, my sweet, embraceable you. I'm going to leap forward into in natural light. I didn't know whether I was going to read this poem, but I was moved by Haki's poems about his mother and his father, and This is a poem about my mother. It's called A Place That's Known. The title comes from a song that was popular in the First World War, A Place That's Known to God Alone and Let the Rest of the World Roll By. But I wrote this poem thinking that the beginning of my life as a poet is in this moment someplace. It begins with my mother's in the hospital at the end of her life and goes back to the past. Oh, I have to say that because people misunderstand these words, part of this poem takes place in a plaza, which can be easily misunderstood as a very fancy place. I lived in the housing project, and the squares in the housing project were called plazas. So I lived on Community Avenue Plaza in Omaha, Nebraska, a place that's known. Out on the front step 50 years ago, my mother beside the 4 o'clocks, smoking her last Chesterfield of the night, locusts strumming, radio dramas, and anger practiced through open windows, the plaza beginning just where her anklets crossed, American elms opening a span of western sky. Sky outside her hospital window, spring gray and full of the plains, droplets sigh against the glass, wind out of Norfolk and Kearney brimming their emptiness. We are silent now, watching the thin, transparent oxygen tube rise and fall at the vein where it crosses her neck. One and one and one, not a sequence, but something failing to start, ending. Her hands seem longer than I had thought, the still curve from wristbone to fingertip, fingernail ridges the same as my own. My hand, my fingers begin and end in hers. Slipping away, they say, one breath, no others. I remember singing, a dance spun across the linoleum's worn flowers, her hair pressed into his chest, the zenith's pale dial, words of the song that stopped the dancing, everyone staring into the music, 7 up, blushed with port, war. I'd like to leave it all behind and go and find, somewhere in the west, in a space of green edged with gold and sky blue, something the plaza might have given way to if we listened hard and held tight. Like the night his face appeared in the back window, hitchhiked from Kearney, rail thin and cold. And she sighed and scolded and leaned against him. What hospital, he said, wishing it away. That night we huddled into our wishes as later into relics and stories, evenings full of the past. The green strongbox opened bits of his life and hers, spread out over white chenille, each object held and named, rosary, scapular, catechism, gun, rewrapped in cloth or paper and locked away. Your father, your grandmother, my dad, she said into the broken night. Sirens edging toward us. The fight across the way spilt down the steps into the plaza's hopscotch, knife flash or skillet lid, a razor's band of blue darkness moving across soft skin as smoothly as sweat, blood quick as a tear. Summer night and poverty's continual rage, voices, hands, fists rising and falling, accusations and recriminations breaking through windows out of doors. Your father, she said, and your grandmother, the boat, the island, the train, the long dusty tilt of the world, how they sang and danced. One voice all those years against the clamor, stories and names against blood-soaked hand towels, against heels pounding down the walk, screams, drowned children, scaldings, flesh drawn up and pink, stretcher after stretcher, cover their eyes, their faces, so many stomachs clutched in pain. Your father, she said, my mother, and sleep. Another short Chicago poem and another bus and subway poem called Eclogue. How sudden they seem, the gradual lives of flowers, or the faces you see in the brief light of a B stop, taking, as you always do, the A train. I'm proud of that. Bill Russo set that to music. I'll read a Russo poem later. This little piece about poetry and the world and Eros, called From the Petrarchan Folio. I wouldn't represent myself well if I didn't have one of these arcane poems in here. This is from a northern Italian folio of Petrarchan sonnets. And in that period, paper was so rare that people wrote all over it. So you had the Petrarchan sonnet, and then people writing, including Lucrezia Borgia, other things in the folio. The thing that matters here is a poem by a man named Laurentino Segni, who was a scribe as well as a poet, and conscripted the poem. And what he does is he takes the Laura from the Petrarch poem and steals her in the way described in the poem. So from the Petrarchan folio, parenthesis 42, R, standing for recto, the right side of the page. In the hand of the original scribe, an inverted triangle. It says she had been seen in Avignon, her face at least, in Simona Martini's wall, long since destroyed. So they presumed upon her, each one of them scribbling, Bembo in 1472, Segni in his own sonnet, where she is said to triumph, though he set down his own name in an acrostic, Loreo then and Laurentio, joined at the poem's first corner. Loreo, quick among the leaves, all that is said of her years even past her death, the pen stiff whispering at the point of her initial then, touch, the scribe's stained finger, stain of all that might be said in her name, name initiating this rustling tree just past his window, a sway with her, Loreo spoken, Laurentio proposed, herself fleshed as the pen point sighs, or the eye catches her initial letter, and the tongue lifts itself into the voiceless onset of her name. Poetry is a strange eros indeed. This is a poem, an elegy, set on the south side of Chicago. It is it's called Incidental Music, and it's for my friend, the great poet A.K. Ramanujan, who lived in Hyde Park and taught at the University of Chicago for years and was the director of the Southeast Asian Institute there, but a truly great poet. And some of the material in this poem comes from his poetry, also from Hyde Park. What you need to know here is that he was also the translator of the Tamil Anthology of Love Poems, a very peculiar book in which poets over a period of 300 years contributed these dramatic monologues in five different voices, what he said, what she said, what his friend said, what her mother said, and so forth. And every poem was written in one of these voices. And then, like a lot of Oriental poems and poems from these long-standing poetic traditions, there are flowers that indicate regions and seasons. There are four regions mentioned in the poem, and then there's a fifth, which is a region of desolation and death. That's called Thai. And I thought about it for a long time. This poem took a long while to get done because I couldn't figure out a way to get out of it. And two things saved the poem. The flock of parakeets down on 53rd Street in Chicago, across from where Harold Washington used to live. That flock of parakeets. And then remember thinking of Thai as the sound of the steel brush on a snare drum. Okay, so incidental music. The trick of the poem, all poems have devices of one kind or another, is that it's a pastoral elegy set on the south side of Chicago. Some pastoral. So, incidental music. Stylus bobbing above dark vinyl like a dragonfly. Mozart, then Horace Silver, their bright waters, onyx spun across shale. It must have been the basement used record store on Hyde Park Boulevard. Hubcaps and wheel lugs at eye level. Cities seem so purposeful. Their music's half-formed, urgent as traffic. Lake effect snow, the day not quite cold enough, brightens the pavement only momentarily. Laughter and exhaust plumes, their sudden clarities passing across the midway, science and industry twang. What flowers should we drift along this course of dampened asphalt in your memory, Rahman? Mulai, Karinchi, Maratam, Natal, each blossom a precinct in song, forest, mountain, clear stream, or dark sea. And what transpires there, a bird among the millet, pepper vine, and palmyra, their moistened palms extended, fresh blossoms and finger symbols. In archaic Tamil, then, what he said, what she said, generations of poets massed along the stations of song. Nearby, the city's improbable flock of brooding parakeets stirs a sudden iridescence above bare box elder and salt-nettled pines. The faith we have in song exceeds its melodies, notes struck in speech we only imagine speaking. Music surged then, hand raised in breath, stylus fingered above syllables, not feeling merely, but how we take its measure, pronounce inadequately, patai, the fifth region, flowerless, a place of separation, note held against emptiness, a saxophone size, steel brush on brass, the beat extended, patai, patai, petals opening, iridescent, bird flowers, city singers are blowing in their hands. Well, somebody got in touch with me who's writing an essay about my dedications, and so sent along a set of questions about the dedications in my poem. So there are a couple dedications that occur here. First, a dedication for Reginald Gibbons, who's here, if I can find the poem. I did. You're next, Angela. So this is called After a Drawing on Papyrus, and it literally is, as I said to the fellow by email, after a drawing that Reg did on papyrus, and the figure described, it's part fox and part lady, is in the drawing. After a Drawing on Papyrus for Reg Gibbons. Dark lady in the pale fox's dream, fox, the underside of her candor. Imagine, she says, my will in your eyes, your quick purpose, the onset of desire. How the night softens into small gestures, scents, a moist trail, prey as certain as my name, now half forgotten. Oh, self, self, I am drifting toward a purer form of hunger. And since we had that, we'll have Angela, who is also here. This poem really came out of reading the Northwestern collection of Angela's work, and this quotation, A Cup Full of Syllables, and it's called Three Winter Songs. It's very much set in the city. But I like the idea of Angela sitting there in the morning in the kitchen with a cup full of syllables and an African violet. So they both get into the poem. Three Winter Songs. One, silence and in its attendant particles, lint spun along the window shade's bright fissure, morning light, the kitchen's moist air quavering, crazed radiator, windowsill, pale velvet, untended, brittle African violet leaves, hands, fingertips, syllables paced out one breath at a time against the table edge, do sway, do dance. City, if love is a circle and morning is its radius, can night be its center? Or the darkness that surrounds it played at or among as though it were shaped into tree forms and gangways, spaces your breath recalls or footsteps strike as you go quickly, the passing contours of bark and brickwork, yours by right of unprovoked remembering. Whose body is this anyway, leaning? Whose spirit lifts your arms now, your voice soft and unexpected? Child's play, these unlit presences, past, traced in sooted snow, bits of bright glass held beneath darkened ice, the way home, the way back, alley after alley, street names rung out, center of course and perimeter bent inward with your fingers, and what is held there and said once again, a song, nouns reeling to their own sweet whisperings. Do sway, do dance. Fingertips, fingernails busy with words, a song does leaf here, And what you say now says its flowering is made of light and water, snow quick and greening, petaled, sepaling syllables, say street, say lamppost, brickbat, what is scrawled red on gray concrete, called out, arms asway, and bare shoulders, counting the music, summer, all that the snow's pale present covers, layers in and slows, rises in your throat, and flares across the window's chill pane. Well, let's see. These are from the new collection, which is a big collection called Heat Lines, and they were published in a limited edition with artist prints called Once Again Flowered. But I'm going to read a couple of. Well, I'll read the long one. I don't want to test your patience. This is another poem set on the south side of Chicago. This really represents, for me, an understanding of the place where I lived and is one of those attempts to come to terms with the riches that exist in the city and their strange, complex, and frightening history. I'll tell you a little bit about the poem. The study of my apartment on the South Michigan faced the block between Michigan and Indiana streets. That place has a deep history, particularly in the history of music, the profound history of music in America. It was a part, 31st Street was a part of a thing called the Stroll, which began on 26th and State, went down to 35th, and crossed over. The Lincoln Gardens, where King Oliver played and Louis Armstrong first played in Chicago, was at the corner of 31st and Calumet. The Plantation Club, which is a blues club much later in the century, was right at the corner of 31st and Indiana. One of the things, the central events of the poem is the death of Sonny Boy Williamson, a blues singer, who was killed in the doorway of the building, which is now torn down as Burrell's gas station, right on that corner. So there's an incredible amount of richness here. The poem invokes several other people, Marion Little Walter Jacobs, who was killed in the street, Blind Lemon Jefferson, who was killed in the streets in Chicago, so it invokes that, reaches backward to jazz, but is, at its surface, oddly, an elegy for Curtis Mayfield. There was a building while I was sitting there staring out the window, torn down across the street. When they tore the building away, a bit of plaster and wallpaper was left from the previous building. It looked like a person with wings above the street. I put that in my notes beginning in about 1971. It stayed there in one way or another, drawings, descriptions. And it wasn't until Curtis died, and I began thinking about this again, that the poem came together. There are two other people in the poem you probably know. Leon Forrest, who was my great good friend and who guided me through my understanding of the South Side, as imperfect as it is. And Sterling Plump, who's a great authority on blues music, and my good friend and colleague. So they're spoken to in the poem, as well as Curtis. The Eunice in the poem, by the way, for peculiar historical knowledge, is Eunice Savage, that is Congressman Gus Savage's wife, who makes a brief but notable appearance in the poem. The poem is called Steal Away, and it begins with a quotation from my friend and former student Jeffrey Allen, "The dead are caretakers." So steal away. You'll recognize Superfly, I assume. In the end, at the ending, everything retreats. Farewell, daylight, and all your objects. The Jeffrey bus rocks around the curve below my window, its cabinet of artificial light. Sing the lion-headed storefront lost to discount gas pumps. Barbershop Leon whispered away. Who died here, shanked on his way to play the blues, Sterling? Chorus gone silent. I remember Curtis rounding his round face with a smile. Superfly, can you see him outlined in the plaster clinging to an exposed brick wall, the remnants of one house illustrating another stained wallpaper fresco, its sainthood, a dream grown arms, legs, dance step in silhouette. Are they sad then, sad captains of sad songs? Can you, he says, can you dig it? Or will you? It no longer seems to be a question. Sonny Boy and Curtis, each smile peaked church roof prisms the distance. South, you say, on Indiana, toward Teresa's pig's ears on Wonder Bread, a slice of life honey, the lines in her palms like squid ink drawn across parchment. Sepia, of course, no more, no less. Who was it then? The sodium lights yellowing toward evening. Looks can be deceiving. The stroll not so much as raised his hand or dipped his head to say hello. Calluses zinging across strings, blind perhaps, or playing, someone said, just like a blind man, or learned to play watching a blind man play. Blind lemon branching from a blind tree, Leon. And so seems that way, all sound without light, without sight reading, the exact dip of head and shoulders stroll just past where the L screeches out his name. Can you? The question is its own answer. See him, Sonny Boy, gone to shadows superfly. Can you reach into the moist coil the song leaves turning in the night air, its bright scales chilling your fingers, uncoils, then recoils, tongue flicking the lilt of things, the lilt things sometimes take, names passing by, arms shoe-bopping, heel cleats, drag out the beat, coils in the night's ear, song. Can you see just there, like a paper cutout, little Walter going this way, blind lemon that, St. James steeple and Olivet's stone face. Eunice said, look here, it doesn't matter what you think or who you think you are. As a man crouched behind a bureau with two children and a loaded gun thinks you're the way back from too far, and all that matters is that he thinks you are. At some point in our lives, we might each of us be called upon to be what we seem, superfly, accidental saint suspended above church fronts and oncoming headlights. Say what it is that's rung out track after track, the brightness steelwork leaves across steel, names, or how too far's edge draws us along like a third rail, its sparks opening quick constellations, their sudden horoscopes etched into the backs of our eyes, lines, names like hands raised in song, moist sepia drawing in the half-light, stroll, Oliver Hines Armstrong, 101 changes down the line, names, how they ring, superfly. Can you see him, Sonny Boy, Sterling? The cord dead fingers clutch at in the summer air, moist as song and sacrament, Leon. The figure in paper and plaster, can you see him in flight? Or the body, hands stretching toward song, folded into a doorway? Listen up, listen up. Too far is a song and dance, is hands raised, is coil and rail returning. Well, I promised the Russo. Russo has an orchestral piece for the Chicago Jazz Ensemble called Chinatown. And this is a little play on that called Chinatown for Bill Russo. It was written before he died, so it doesn't refer to his death. It's how they said it, like tangerine or Cherokee in Bridgeport, that is, Chinatown. Where are you from? Meaning what neighborhood, what street corner? Chinatown, a privilege more certain than Taylor Street, deeper perhaps by misdirection, not Chinese in any sense, not Chinatown proper, merely adjacent to it, but meaning something else altogether, a special sense not of place, but of value, value acquired in place, acquiring place as in Chinatown. All right, I'll wind up. A couple of very recent poems then. To end, I always like to read something that's new and you don't just seem like a performer. My friend Marvin Bell, who teaches at Iowa, sent me a note saying that he had to give a talk and do a reading related to the opening of an exhibit of Italian and Roman art in Cedar Rapids. And he wanted to know if I could suggest any poems to read. And then I think laughingly said, I need something that would stir the interest of a farmer harvesting his crops in northern Iowa. Well, I sent him a list of some Italian and Roman poems, and then I thought, well, I can do that. So I wrote this poem, which is almost entirely stolen from the Roman poet Virgil and from the Georgics. And I was astonished, going back to the Virgil, at how incredibly particular Virgil's attention to farming was, and then blown away by the thing that happens at the end of the poem. But so this is taken from about four of the Georgics and pieced together. So a Georgic from Marvin Bell. Virgil talked of corn, of farmers at their work, the shadows that move up their hillsides at evening, rain, sunlight after rain, and cloudless skies, of plants that rise up unbidden and bear no fruit, birds and their plunder, salt land and gravel, and rich soil that falls black from the plow's shear, of land flat and glad with moisture, of stubble left fallow, and the crust on unstirred fields, fierce sun and frostbite, how in time the crop levels the furrow, how mildew devours the corn stalks, how thistle and burrs can overcome a crop, and of the farmer at home, sweet children clinging to his knees, the holidays kept, and the sacred piety of his household. Under the shade of a spreading beech, Virgil sang of fields and flocks and trees, of bees among ripening apples, shrill locusts, haylofts, and brimming water troughs, and thought of tillers marched away, the plow's measure of honor gone, of Caesar bending sickles into stiff sword blades and hurling war's lightnings at the high Euphrates. And then the poem that the Poetry Center did on this broadsheet, which is very nice and is brand new. It comes literally from listening to an interview with the astonishing singer Diane Reeves. And somebody asked Diane Reeves what the source of scat was, and she gave the usual historic answers and then said, I really think it's the spirit singing. And the poem sort of came into view because of that. So it's called Rain Dancing. I'd never thought of the fact that snapping your fingers and setting a top into motion is the same activity. So that happens in the poem. Rain Dancing. Settle it then. The syllable snapped between your finger and your thumb, skidding briefly and spun, a wooden top wobbling across an uneven floor, sound as certain as rain dancing, spirit after spirit, random, predictable, and strange, leaves in their own sweet time and frequent melody. Thank you.